I stopped trying to tell them. And then I didn't want, during the 21 years that I was teaching here, I just wanted to be evaluated as a teacher, not as a Holocaust survivor.
Hi there, it's WAMC News Director Ian Pickus. And on this episode of the WAMC News Podcast, we profile an amazing life, that of 96-year-old retired SUNY Plattsburgh professor Vladimir Monk. This episode really belongs to WAMC's North Country Bureau Chief Pat Bradley, who's been reporting on a new documentary. Return to Auschwitz is the story of Monk's survival of the Nazi death camp. The movie details the experiences of Monk as he returned to the concentration camp in early 2020, when he was 95. First, we'll hear Pat's story on Monk and the film, and later in this episode, extended interviews with Monk and the filmmakers.
I have never been in Auschwitz since 1945. I don't know how I will feel when I'll be back. Not that I try to forget, but I try to suppress the thinking about the Holocaust. About my past, I try to live the normal life.
Filmmaker Paul Frederick and documentary co-producer Bruce Carlin had previously recorded an interview with Vladimir Monk, but had yet to use it. When offered the chance to document Monk's return to Auschwitz, he felt it was a story they could not ignore.
You know, I agreed to do the first interview just because we wanted to capture it, you know, sooner than later, and you can't help but fall in love with him as soon as you meet him and talk to him. We got as much as we could. And then in November of that year, Julie said, oh, by the way, he just got asked to go back, and I'm going with him. I was like, wow, this will never happen again. We'll never get this opportunity to do it again. Julie was going to be with Vladimir for the duration of while they were over there, and then I would have to film that, but then go to his hometown where he grew up, which was part of Bica, and then go to Prague, where he went after the war.
Carlin Media is a small production company in Plattsburgh. Owner and co-producer Bruce Carlin said it was a daunting prospect to film the documentary, not only logistically, but emotionally.
I have an interest in World War II. My mother was British, is British, and her hometown was bombed constantly by the Germans. And so I grew up with, that knowledge and my mother telling me about the Holocaust. Learning about Theresienstadt, the first concentration camp, was really new to me. I did not know that much about that particular camp, which was not an extermination camp. It was a transit camp. Learning that this was part of this horrific ordeal and fate for these people. But, you know, being on the grounds of it, you don't even have the words, you know, to say the evil.
Does being here after 75 years, is it what you imagined, or is it different than what you've been thinking about all these years when you sort of pictured it in your mind?
It's not so real as it was 75 years ago, because it's empty. Yeah. When we came here, it was full of these barracks on both sides. The feeling is the same as it was the first time. It must be very depressing for you too, right? When you look around it, it's unreal. Look at it.
It is unreal. It is unreal.
It's unreal. Yeah, for me, I would say it's a certain closure because I can't do anything more for all the deaths. They were my relatives, but at least I did this, that I came back to the end of my own life to see where their life ended. It's really like going to the cemetery to say goodbye.
Again, Paul Frederick.
It still, I think, stays with me. It changes you for sure going there. You know, there was one part in the film, he says a few things and Julie has a hard time and starts choking back some tears. I can tell you all three of us were choking back tears at that moment. It literally hit all three of us And yeah, tears were rolling down all our faces at that moment.
Monk's biographer Julie Canepa first met him when she sang in a duo at his retirement home. She accompanied him to the concentration camp in Poland as his guardian and narrates the documentary.
He always said that he never let what had happened to his family define him throughout his life. And I think I really saw that part of his character during that trip, that he could be very strong and compassionate and feel pain for his family and for the loss, but also have just this inner ability to persevere that goes beyond what it would seem to me the average person has.
I made it.
You made it.
There was an exhibit Vladimir insisted on seeing which focused on the fate of the Bohemian Jews of which he and his family were a part. The exhibit was in his native Czech, and his intimate knowledge of the fate and events which befell the Czech Jews brought out the teacher in him. Soon, he was leading the tour, and our guide was asking him questions. A map depicts the concentration and extermination camps to which Jews were deported as Czechoslovakia was made systematically Jew-free. Most were sent to Theresienstadt and later to their deaths at Auschwitz. Mm-hmm.
18,400 and 1,500 survived.
And you're one of them.
Yeah.
Everyone who visits Monk's apartment at the Lake Forest Senior Center in Plattsburgh is offered a shot of Slivovitz, Czech, plum brandy as soon as they walk in. His apartment is filled with artwork, and he's proud of his cooking skills. But one thing Monk did not talk about for many years was his experience at the Nazi death camps.
When I came here in 1969, we learned how terrible it was during the war because they couldn't get this, they couldn't get that. So I stopped trying to tell them. And then I didn't want, during the 21 years that I was teaching here, I just wanted to be evaluated as a teacher, not as a Holocaust survivor. And there was reason to it, because I was invited at the beginning, once I was invited to the nursing department, and they asked me about how I went through the concentration camp. And one question was, do you feel guilty that you survived when your parents were perished and so many relatives perished? I said, why should I feel guilty that I survived? So I just didn't talk about it. When I retired, I decided, yeah, now it's the time to tell the children not how what is Holocaust or definition and politics, but how I went through it.
Monk said he had thought for a long time about returning to Auschwitz. He was invited to the 75th anniversary of the liberation of the camp and accepted the opportunity to visit.
Most of my relatives, including my parents, ended in Auschwitz. Not all were gassed as my parents were. I knew about those. But the official ending of their life was Auschwitz. But for me, this meant that some 36 or 38 of my close relatives, sisters and brothers of my parents, their sisters and brothers, and my cousins and my nieces, perished or ended in Auschwitz. So when you have a place, when you have 36 of your close relatives, you plan to visit it once a year, or at least once in your lifetime. But it was just my saying goodbye to all my relatives. And this was a good opportunity, and the only one I figured out at 95 to do it.
Monk says throughout his lifetime, he has missed the family connections that so many others have.
You may have 2 relatives, you may have 10 relatives, but you meet once a year around Christmas time or Thanksgiving as a big family, or you visit each other. I don't have anybody. I was in concentration camp since I was 16, 17, and there was no father, there was no mother, no one to tell me, yeah, do this or don't do this. And not often, but from time to time, I really missed advice or just somebody to talk with. I didn't have anybody. So I miss these people.
Frederick says this documentary about Munk is different than many other films about Auschwitz or the Holocaust.
I feel ours is a bit different in the fact of Julie is kind of telling the story through Vladimir. And, you know, she's not a Jewish person and she's younger generation. It's sort of geared towards a younger generation who maybe doesn't know a lot about the Holocaust as a whole. And then we also chose to not be super gruesome with it. I mean, a lot of these films, there's bodies being pushed into graves with bulldozers, and we didn't show that. We didn't feel that was necessary to get the message across and to go back on this journey with Vladimir. You learn about what happened there and the horrors, but we didn't get so graphic. And part of our goal is to have schools use this as a teaching aid. I do think it's a unique approach to this topic.
The documentary, Return to Auschwitz, The Survival of Vladimir Munk, will be shown at the Linda in Albany at 7 p.m. on October 14th. Paul Frederick, Julie Canepa, and Bruce Carlin will host a question and answer session following the screening.
So, Vladimir, we have a documentary that Julie and Bruce and Paul have made. Obviously, you've gotten a chance to see it. What do you make of the documentary?
Should I be serious or should I say a joke? It's available as DVD today. You know it?
In the future. People can order it now and they will get it at, down the line.
Resident assistant, a girl called me this morning that she's going downtown to buy the DVD of video, that it was advertised.
She ordered it,
yeah. And today it's available.
Oh, okay.
It's supposed to be available. Hmm. It's a good video.
It reflects what you thought and...
Saw it twice, and I need some rest before I watch it again. You know, these are pictures that just bring back bad memories, so I don't watch it. I don't want to watch it too often.
Well, why did you decide to go ahead and let them film this documentary?
Well, I said that I will not join. If they want to if they want to film it, it's up to them. I mean, I cannot prevent anybody to film me. So they are a group of three that are collecting all the money.
Yeah. Well, my understanding is that, you know, you didn't talk about this much, you know, for many, many years. And then you started talking to school kids about the Holocaust and everything. Do you feel it's important for people to remember what happened, especially these days?
Well, it's not quite true. When I came here in 1969, even after the war in 1945, 1946, when I returned and I tried to tell them how it was, everybody in Europe suffered very much. In the United States, they didn't have enough gas to drive the cars, for example. So when he came to the United States, we learned how terrible it was during the war because they couldn't get this, they couldn't get that. They stopped us talking and because they had to tell us how they suffered. The same was in Europe. So I stopped trying to tell them, you see, there is a little bit difference. Because they really saw that they were. And then I didn't want, during the 21 years that I was teaching here, I just wanted to be evaluated as a teacher, not as a Holocaust survivor. If you know, and there was reason to it, because I was invited at the beginning, once I was invited to the nursing department, they had social studies or something, and they asked me about how I went through the concentration camp. And one question was, Do you feel guilty that you survived when your parents were perished and so many relatives perished? He said, why should I feel guilty that I survived? It was not up to me to tell you the truth. And that was the position of many citizens here, that we are guilty of something because we are here, we were supposed to be dead. The fact is that my good friend who committed suicide when he was over 70 was thinking about the same thing. He told me, you know, we were supposed to be dead the last 40 years. He was in the hospital after operation, didn't feel well, hanged himself in the bathroom. And he was talking about just committing suicide for a long time. He told me, you will be one of the first who will learn that I committed suicide. I feel that I am not supposed to be here. I am supposed to be dead for a long time. So I just didn't talk about it. When I retired, I decided, yeah, now it's the time to tell the children, well, they were in the middle class and in the high school, what is Holocaust or definition and politics, but how I went through it, what I lived through, how I succeeded to survive it. I called it a Hollywood version of Holocaust surviving, which means I just skipped gas chambers and dead bodies and something like this. But students liked it, and students remember it.
What's the biggest message you're trying to tell the students when you do talk to them?
Well, I didn't try to give them a message, but the basic message was do not give up. Do not give up, because most of us, I was one of those who didn't give up, but most people during the concentration camp gave up, which means you get up in the morning and you washed yourself with ice cold water and you ate a piece of bread or something, and then you worked or pretend to work for 10 hours, then you came home and you slept. And at a certain point, they just gave up. They stopped washing themselves. They just were too lazy to get up, so they were beaten. And 2 weeks later, they were dead. Not to give up was very difficult. There were people who were very religious, so they prayed in the morning, they prayed in the evening, and they believed in the God, and they trusted it's up to the God if they survive or if they not survive. Some survived. If it was God's will or not, I don't know. I don't know. But they were not heroes. One of the Holocaust heroes in the United States is Anne Frank. Anne Frank was a nice girl, but she didn't survive. So she's not a hero. The heroes are those who actually survived the whole thing. I was not religious. I was religious when I probably went to concentration camp, and even then we were very, very, very Jewish, because once you are born Jewish, you just cannot get out of it. But we were not very religious Jewish, and so I didn't pray. I prayed when I was a small kid, just for the God to bless everybody or something like this, but then I didn't. And when I saw the things that were happening in the Holocaust, I stopped believing in the God. I stopped believing because I said, if there is a God, how can he permit it? Does God cease that they are murdering people? They are not, okay, everybody has some sins. I said, you may say, yeah, we deserve to be killed or something like this for ourselves. But 2 months little child is not sinning. And they were killing them in mass, right? So I thought, one believes in God because God is omnipotent and powerful. Why didn't he, if he is really powerful, omnipotent, he should stop this. why didn't he stop it? He couldn't stop it. If he couldn't stop it, he's not omnipotent. So why should I believe in somebody else who can do something but not could do anything, do everything? And if he can do everything and doesn't do it, then he is the same in the same line as the Nazis were. So how can you believe in somebody else who approves or doesn't stop this mass murder? So that was my point, and that it is still is. And it was a point of many Jewish people who returned after the Holocaust. And it took a lot of work to the Israelites or Jews who didn't go through the Holocaust in America to start to persuade them that, hey, we do not question God. Well, you do not have to question God, but who can prevent me to question if I want to question him? So that was my point to the Jewish religion now. So the problem of the Jewish community here is what to do with me. Am I Jewish enough to join them, or am I not?
So do you consider yourself an atheist?
You see, I don't want to get involved in a discussion of religion in the United States because Americans are so religious that the Pope is not religious enough for them.
Very true. Let's talk to your trip to Auschwitz. You were invited to go back for the 75th anniversary of the liberation. Was it a difficult decision when you received the letter of invitation?
Well, I was not invited. I got a letter informing me that there is this charitable organization, Auschwitz-Birkenau Memorial Foundation. I didn't know about it. And that they will pay every surviving Auschwitz person who is able to travel and is willing to attend the liberation memories or something like this. And it was in my mind for a long time that I should maybe go to Auschwitz because most of my relatives, including my parents, ended in Auschwitz. Not all were gassed as my parents were. I knew about those. Some of them went from Auschwitz to some other concentration camps, but the official ending of their life was Auschwitz. That's documented, that they were sent in this and this transport to Auschwitz. What happened to them later, sometimes we don't know. But for me, this meant that some 36 or 38 of my close relatives, and the close relatives means sisters and brothers of my parents, their sisters and brothers, and my cousins and my nieces, perished or ended in Auschwitz. So when you have a place, when you have 36 of your close relatives, you plan to visit it once a year, or at least once in your lifetime. And as I was ending my life, I thought maybe I should just. I didn't know what to expect, what my feeling will be when I'll be in Auschwitz. But it was just my saying goodbye to all my relatives. And this was a good opportunity and the only one I figured out at 95 to do it, because they offered all the expenses paid for, and it was a question of 2 days. So the risk was, yes, do I have to go for 2 days over nearly 8,000 miles to Europe and back? And I said, yeah, I could not do it alone, but hey, Julie was just sitting around here. I don't know what she was doing. And I turned to her and said, would you like to go to Auschwitz? I said, yeah, I'd love to. Because I was thinking, whom will I take? People usually take family members. Normally, I would take one of my sons. They were families there. The Auschwitz survivor had dementia. He or she didn't know what's happening. And the whole family went with him. And then they returned back, and the whole next year was just talk and talk and talk about how they were in Auschwitz and what they saw in Auschwitz. I had two sons. One was still working. The other was overweight, has diabetes, and that I would end just taking care of him instead of he taking care of me. And here was young lady, healthy, strong, willing to do it. So we went.
I watched the documentary online. They sent me a link where I could watch it online. And there were certain portions of it where Julie seemed to get a lot more emotional than you when you were at Auschwitz. How emotional was this visit for you? And is this just something where you had prepared yourself before you went for the emotions that you might feel?
No. First of all, I haven't been there. I have been there in 44. And before I was in Terezin, which was not comparable. But then from Auschwitz, I went to some other concentration camp, which were comparable to Auschwitz because they were satellite camp of Auschwitz. So it was nothing, just to see it, it was nothing new to me. And on the contrary, because when I was there, there were barracks. That was like living concentration camp. Here it was just preserved. The land like was preserved, but the barracks were torn down. They had one barrack just to show how it looked. I looked inside the barrack, and that was it. So I was not affected too much with being there. But altogether, yeah, it just depressed me. Just to be there, thinking about all my relatives and everything, was depressing. And it's the same thing now when I just watch the video. I watched the video 3 times, right, in a relatively short period of time. The last time when I watched it, I was depressed.
Yeah. In one scene, you're at the wall where it lists all of the Czechs that perished. And at the very end, it shows that there's a little over 1,500 who survived. And both you and Julie say you're one of those that survived. Did you feel uplifted by that? How did you feel about being one of the survivors when you saw that?
I don't feel guilty. I don't feel guilty. But what I feel is I missed it during my lifetime, all the relatives. Because you may have 2 relatives, you may have 10 relatives, but you meet once a year around Christmas time or Thanksgiving as a big family, or you visit each other, or you are in written contact or by phone or something like this. I don't have anybody. You know, when I returned, I was 20 years old. I was in concentration camp since I was 16, 17, and now I didn't have anybody to advise me or to tell me to do this or not to do this. I was thinking, what will I do? I missed all the school. I ended high school, and that was it. My friends ended, just graduated and started to go to universities. I missed the higher high school to get in the university. Now I was thinking, so what? I am here now. Will I continue to work as a locksmith something that I learned in concentration camp, or should I try to catch up with all the others and study, which I planned to do before the war? And there was no father, there was no mother, no one to tell me, yeah, do this or don't do this. And during my later life, not often, but from time to time, I really missed advice or just somebody to talk with, like the parents are here for. Usually you do not like your parents when you are a teenager, but once you are adult, it's a good person who is one generation older because he or she went through all these problems that you are going through. I didn't have anybody. So I miss these people. And later on, I miss some of the relatives.
That reminds me, towards the end of the film, it asks, you know, what would the 6 million people who died have contributed? And I thought about how the film highlights how, you know, you've taught hundreds of students, you know, you have a number of patents, you know, you received the Chancellor's Award for Excellence from the SUNY system. You received awards for your work when you worked in Czechoslovakia, and you're just one individual. How do you think the world might be different? How do you think those 6 million people who died, what they might have done?
You see, I'll mention this. This is one advice my father gave me, and that I remember, that if you want to achieve something, you either have to be smarter than the others, which is difficult and usually doesn't happen, or you work a little bit more than the others. When you work a little bit more, it add, and finally, yes, you achieve something that the others didn't. So, not being smarter than the others, I spent more time working in the laboratory or reading and studying at home, and it added. Some other people, and I came here to Plattsburgh, and it was practically the same, because what I saw was the guys were teaching, they had 8 or 10 hours contact hours, which means the lectures and laboratory, and they played golf and they enjoyed life. I didn't have the money and I didn't know how to play golf, so I was studying during the weekends. And after several years, yes, I achieved something that all the others or most of the others didn't achieve. Not only the confidence of the students, but they started to like my lectures because I didn't try to show them what I know. Yeah. And some of the professors do this even now. Now they graduate and they have a little bit of practice and they come and they lecture and they try to give the students everything they know and even more than they know, and that only confuses the student. For the students, you have to be very selective and tell them the basics. And the kids started to like my lectures. And finally, yeah, they recommended me for Chancellor's Award. And I have a lot of former students, and they are successful, and some of them are professors at the universities, and they remember how I taught and what I told them. So that was it.
Vladimir, in the documentary you said that to survive, you couldn't be nice. And yet everybody that mentioned you says that you're one of the nicest people they meet. So how do you explain that?
Well, when you look at the person, you have to make your own judgment about her. And my judgment always, I looked at Julie, I tried to figure her out in the wartime, suppose in the SS uniform, how would she behave if she will be a guard in the concentration camp? And then you say, okay, she may be a bitch. Or she may not be. So I always try to figure people from the nice side. Because otherwise you will become a policeman or a prison guard or somebody who suspect everybody doing some bad things. And I couldn't do this.
What do you hope the documentary
You know, what message do you hope that people who watch the documentary, you know, that they get from it?
I am not quite sure if the documentary will last a long time or if it's just a period of time that everybody is interested in it. If it will last a little bit longer, I hope so, because they plan to use the documentary in teaching Holocaust studies at the high schools. Then it will give the students now some ideas how it was 50, 60, 70 years or 80 years or 100 years ago, which means, because for the young generation now, Holocaust is something like civil war to us. It's old history. They didn't live through it. They even do not know how it looked like. And they will see that 100 years ago, or not even 100 years ago, people were willing to kill other people for nothing, just for being Jewish, for some religion, or even not for that. And they enjoyed it.
Are you worried that something similar to the Holocaust or something even worse than the Holocaust could happen again?
I don't want to say that I am worried, because I'll be here for 2 more years or 3 more years, so nothing worries me anymore. But, yeah, it could happen. It could happen. I mean, when you take a look at the former president, Donald Trump, he would be one who would be willing to put people in concentration camp or do whatever he could do just to become the so-called president. And it will be he was not alone. He had the whole staff. I mean, how many, several hundred people were in the White House, and they all agreed with him. Not one person opposed him. Not one person went public and say, this is not how it's supposed to be. And you have some of the senators and congressmen, you have now Republican Party, and how many, 80% of Republican Party are still supporting Trump's ideas. So, yeah, it can happen. I hope that it will not happen, but it happened several times in other countries.
Do you ever regret not going back to Auschwitz earlier in your life?
I don't think that it would make any difference. Only I don't know if I was too lazy to go there. Most probably there will be some complication, expenses. And I was not quite sure that it would help me. But the older I was getting and the more I was sitting here, and the recent years when she started to write about me and I just revitalized my memories, somehow it pushed me to do it. Right?
Any comments, Julie?
No, I think the stars aligned. I think Vladimir may have had an opportunity to go to Auschwitz in 2015 when his wife Kitty was near the end of her life, and that was obviously not the time for him to go. And something about the nature of our friendship that had evolved, and then this offer coming, and everything just sort of converged onto this moment where this was the right time to go and tell his story, so that and we're certainly hoping that the story and Vladimir stick around for a long time so that more people can hear it.
Yeah, you still got a few years in you, I think, Vladimir.
Well, knock on the door, knock on the wood.
You're healthier than some folks, I know.
When you live in Lake Forest, you can see that it comes very fast and unexpectedly. Oh. There is a person sitting at the dining room eating dinner, gets up, drops dead, and that's it. And that's how we wish it to happen. There is nothing better than just to die very fast.
Yeah. I guess with everything he's seen, maybe that's the best advice.
I always say, very fast, just not now.
Just not now. Yeah, I like that. Anything else that you want to, you know, tell people about your life or the Holocaust or anything else?
No, I am not the person who is involved in helping people to go through life. Everybody has his or her own way. I am willing to talk with them. I am willing to help them if I can, but otherwise that's their problem.
Okay. Vladimir, it's great to meet you.
It was nice to meet you too.
Yeah. Julie, should I be asking him anything else?
I think that kind of covers that. Not anything I can think
Julie
of.
Julie starts asking after she drinks some wine.
She's writing the book after all.
I think one thing that I was thinking when you were asking about that moment when we were in the Czech building at Auschwitz and we were looking at the number of survivors and we looked at how few had survived, and we were reflecting that Vladimir was one of those few. And there are so few survivors left to tell their stories, so that's one of the reasons why telling his story is so important right now. And something came up during 9/11 where they were talking about how that had already faded from the collective memory. So if you think that's something that just celebrated its had its 20th anniversary has faded from collective memory, and this is 75 years ago, then now more than ever, it's important to tell the story of this survivor.
How did the documentary come about?
Well, I would say let Julie start it at all. So.
Oh, so the long, convoluted story.
I can take that off.
So in the beginning, way back when, I was going to write the series of articles for The Sun, and I was getting to know Vladimir and getting to know his story. And I felt like it warranted something more than just writing a few articles. So I had seen Paul's project that he had done, Heart's Delight, the minor movie, and he had done such a fabulous job on that. And I don't know where I got the idea that he would just want to do something for free, but I begged him, and we talked, and he understood the value of getting Vladimir's story on video and how important that was. So he volunteered his time, and we sat down with Vladimir and did a four-hour interview. And after it was done, we said, great, and we had no money, nothing to do, there was nowhere we could go with it. So we just kind of sat on that for a while, and then when Vladimir got the letter to go to Auschwitz, that was when things really changed. He spoke to Bruce immediately and said, look, there's this opportunity. He's just been invited to go back to the 75th anniversary of the liberation of the camp. And Bruce said, we have to do this. We have to go on this trip. And so all of a sudden, within just a few weeks of us leaving for the trip, they were getting themselves organized, and Bruce was booking plans, and Paul was getting ready to bring all of his equipment on this cross-national trip and get that down for posterity. So,
Julie, one of the things that I noted in the documentary is that, you know, you were taking a look at the history of the Holocaust, and you ended up meeting Vladimir. Why were you interested in the first place in the history of the Holocaust, and how did that lead you to meeting Vladimir Munch?
Actually, strangely enough, when I was young, I actually did have quite an interest in the Holocaust. I read a lot of books when I was probably in maybe middle school and high school, but my interest in that had waned, I should say, until I met Vladimir. Again, when I met him at Lake Forest, initially, I knew that he was a Holocaust survivor. I didn't really know that much else about him. And as we got to know each other and he told me some stories that were very poignant and I didn't think they had ever been told before, and I felt like it was really important to get those down for people to hear.
And you were a singer at Wake Forest, entertaining the folks that live there.
Right. So my singing partner and I, Tim Hartnett, we used to play for the seniors there. Maybe every few months they would call us and ask us if we wanted to come and play music for an hour. And Vladimir and Tim knew each other. They knew each other through SUNY, and they also knew each other through dog walking. And so I had the pleasure of getting invited back to Vladimir's with Tim as part of the pair that we were. And then I just began getting to know Vladimir independently. So,
Paul Frederick, Julie approached you. This was more or less initially like an oral history project, which you've had a lot of experience with. Is that how you initially approached this?
Yeah. It's basically, I get asked probably a couple times a year to do a fishing show or a cooking show. I can't tell you how many people say, oh, let's go do it. And when it gets picked up, it'll be you that makes them all. And, you know, we'll get paid then. And that's like, I've learned over the years, if you don't have the money up front, it's very hard to get it after. Julie came with this idea, and I was really interested because it was not fishing and not cooking, because that's what I usually get approached for. And when I met Vladimir, you know, I agreed to do the first interview just because we wanted to capture it, and you know, sooner than later. And you can't help but fall in love with him as soon as you meet him and talk to him. And you know, after we shot the interview, it was probably an hour and a half, 2 hours worth of recording. We got as much as we could, and we kind of said, okay, well, we've got it. We'll sit on it for a while. We'll see if we can't find some grants or some kind of money to put this together into a proper documentary. And then in November of that year, Julie said, oh, by the way, he just got asked to go back and I'm going with him. And then it became, I was like, wow, now we've got a show that we've got to do. This will never happen again. We'll never get this opportunity to do it again. But I knew I couldn't do it alone. Julie was going to be with Vladimir for the duration of while they were over there. And then I would have to film that, but then go to his hometown where he grew up, go to which was part of Bica, and then go to Prague where he went after the war, and get a lot of the locations. And, you know, it's Europe, it's different money at each country, it's different languages, and I got all my equipment, and I said, I can't do this alone. And I knew Bruce and I worked together all the time on corporate projects, and I knew he had a really strong interest in World War II, so had that conversation where, do you want to get involved? And before I was done even with the sentence, he said, let's do it. So, and thank God, because I don't think I could have, I know I couldn't have handled all that alone. So we had a very packed week when we were over there shooting.
So Bruce Carlin, how complex was this to organize? You know, as Julie and Paul have mentioned, you were on basically a non-existent budget, but you were going into something that I take it was very complex to not only organize, but actually be out there and shoot.
It was very complex, and I didn't get the scope of how big this liberation commemoration was going to be until we were really right in it. And I knew that they had shut down the I knew that they had shut down the camp. There were no visitors allowed except for people involved in the commemoration. So the first thing we had to do is we had to get the press credentials, and we had to get in during those days. So we had to pay money for a guide ahead of time. We had language barriers. We had money, just wiring money or using, buying things and getting ready. The going to Czech Republic and traveling after the trip to Poland, that was, figuring out what is going to be the cheapest way, but still not be stuck on a bus that's going to take 2 days. So I've traveled around Europe and knew a little bit about the rail system. So we were able to get good rail transportation and, you know, good accommodations. We lucked into a great place that was affordable, and we just had a lot of lucky breaks along the way, but it was a lot of logistical planning. And then you've got the equipment, which Paul had a very compact rig that he had. We didn't even bring a tripod. I think did you have a monopod? A monopod and an SLR camera that was shooting with great lenses. And Paul was able to capture really everything about the trip, especially with Vladimir, especially in the camp. Just, you know, really as if you were there. You know, when I watch it now, obviously I have those memories. But I think that the people that have watched this come away with a feeling of they were there with him, which I think is really special.
One of the things I was wondering, too, I mean, you've got drone footage of the camp, you know, as people are touring and stuff. Is that all your footage, or were you able to borrow footage?
Actually, the drone shots we purchased on a stock footage site. Okay. Just bringing a drone and dealing with overseas laws for drone use was way beyond what we wanted to have to carry with us and deal with, especially as Bruce mentioned, with the language barriers. And so there are a lot of drone shots online that you can buy, and that's what we did just to maximize our time over there and deal with the headaches we had to deal with and not some others like that. What Bruce was talking about, though, as far as the money, we pulled out our credit cards and paid for everything basically that way. And then when we got back, we launched a GoFundMe campaign, and we were able to recoup the shooting expenses, not our time to shoot, because, you know, that is a whole different area, but the out-of-pocket was covered with the GoFundMe, which was awesome to have a whole community get behind us on a project, you know, that they just have to believe in what you're doing. And it was enough to pay our out-of-pocket expenses. And then it took about, with the pandemic, it challenged us to find sponsorship. And currently we're still looking for sponsors to get this out to PBS. The show is finished, and, you know, it was all done in the last year and a half. Took us a little longer probably because of the pandemic too, but the story kept developing during that time. And so, you know, we kept shooting as things would develop with Vladimir during all of that. So, I mean, that gave us a full story. I guess we could have made just the story about his return, but it became much more. It became about his life. And obviously dealing with the pandemic was a big part of the last couple of years for him.
One of the things that I seem to get out of the film was Vladimir's kind of stoicism as he returned to Auschwitz. You know, at one point he says, you know, it's like returning to the cemetery and closing, having closure in that part of his life. And you, Julie, you know, who is accompanying him, seemed to show more emotion at times. And there were times I was wondering if it was difficult for you, Paul, as the camera person, or you, Bruce, as the producer, you know, what sorts of thoughts and what sorts of emotions you were feeling as you were following them, because you were behind the camera, yet you were seeing all of this also. You know, what sorts of emotions and feelings did you get as you went through these historical sites?
I kind of explain it as you have a job you have to do. You have to get this story. We really only had a solid day when we were there with Vladimir to film everything. So you're kind of in work mode, and you're in, you know, I got to get this angle to tell that story. If we need to edit this sequence down, we need to have a cutaway shot. And your brain's working in that way. So it wasn't until, I think, in the hotel that night where it really registered what we just did and how it, you know, it stays with you. It still, I think, stays with me. It changes you for sure going there. and being there with Vladimir and Julie. You know, there was one part in the film, I think it's kind of the emotional climax of it, where he says a few things and Julie has a hard time and starts choking back some tears. I can tell you all three of us were choking back tears at that moment. It literally hit all three of us, and we just kept shooting while we're walking, and the camera keeps rolling for probably another minute. And yeah, tears were rolling down all our faces at that moment. But you just keep going. You got to keep rolling. You don't stop. You handle it at the moment, but it didn't really register until later.
Bruce?
Well, as Paul mentioned, I have an interest in World War II. My mother was British, is British, and her hometown was bombed constantly by the Germans. And so I grew up with, that knowledge and my mother telling me about the Holocaust. And I was very interested in it and have read a lot about it. So learning about Terezin or Theresienstadt, the first concentration camp, was really new to me. I did not know that much about that particular camp, which was not an extermination camp. It was a transit camp. And so that was a lot of, very interesting, and just learning that this was part of this horrific ordeal and fate for these people. But, you know, being on the grounds of it, you don't even have the words, you know, to say the evil.
Julie, how difficult was it for you to maintain your emotions, because you had to be with Vladimir, you had to make sure that he was okay through all of this. You were basically his guardian through all of this.
Well, Vladimir has made it clear over the course of our relationship that he plays his emotions pretty close to the vest. So although I could try to prepare for what he might need from me in that way or how I might feel, there really was no preparing for that. Thankfully, in a way, the challenges of getting through the camp were so many sort of obstacles, just physical obstacles to keeping him safe, that I was more distracted a lot of the time by just his physical safety than I was having to deal with sort of anything that might come up with him on an emotional level. So in a way, I feel like I was almost fortunate that, we were just walking on this. They haven't changed the camp and turned it into a comfortable visitor's walking grounds or anything like that. The grounds that we were walking are the same. They're in the same shape as they were at the end of the war. So there's Vladimir at 90, almost 95, walking the streets of Auschwitz that are broken rocks, and walking into an old barracks where the ground is completely uneven and barely fit for people to walk. And so that really sort of absorbed most of my attention and my time.
What do you think you learned most about Vladimir and about the Holocaust?
Throughout the whole process, I think what I learned about Vladimir is I came away with maybe even more respect and compassion and love for him than I had going into everything. Just, I felt like he was incredibly brave. I think it's one thing to commit to an action. It's another thing to actually be there and go through with it. And I feel like I could really see how he always said that he never let what had happened to his family define him throughout his life. And I think I really saw that part of his character during that trip, that he could be very strong and compassionate and feel pain for his family and for the loss, but also have just this inner ability to persevere that goes beyond what it would seem to me the average person has.
One of the scenes that struck me
fairly short was when you were at the wall with the names of the Czechs that lost their lives. And at the very end of it, it notes that there were only 1,500 Czech survivors. And you guys know Vladimir is one of them. Did that make the making of this documentary even more important in your minds?
Well, I would say that what it brought back to me was how recent this was. I was born in 1960. I think of World War II. I used to think of it as a long time ago. Being born in 1960, that's only 15 years before or after the end of the war. 15 years after the end of the war, I was born, and that could have been my world very easily. My mother, as I said, was English. If Hitler would have taken over Great Britain, he would not have, and continued his world domination, he would not have stopped at just killing Jews. He would have killed everyone that couldn't be a slave to him. So seeing everything in color, seeing these buildings, seeing, hearing the languages, and being there, could have been in my lifetime. At the same time, we have in our country, especially a couple of years ago, there was a lot of day-to-day wondering, where are we going as a people with the president? And how uncivilized are we going to become under this president? And, you know, it really drove home to me that, you know, we really got to be on guard. We have to be on guard, because when we watch the speeches, one of the important things that came from one of the speakers was saying that Auschwitz didn't fall from the sky. It didn't just happen. It started with small things, and then as people accepted them or people ignored them around the world, they became this hell. And so we come back to a country that's, you know, dealing with basically challenges to democracy. So, I mean, could this happen again? You know, I didn't think that we could fall as far as we've fallen, but hopefully we won't. We have to, you know, remember these things so we don't.
The documentary is going to be screened at the Linda in Albany. What will happen during the screening? I don't know which one of you guys wants to.
Well, after the screening, Bruce, Julie, and I will be there. We're going to do a little Q&A if anyone has any questions or comments and they want to talk about it further. It's a little far for Vladimir to travel, especially at that hour, so he's not going to be there, but we'll be there and be happy to talk about it. One thing I would like to say to get people to go is, this film, I think, is different than a lot of the. There are some of these return to Auschwitz type stories out there. I feel ours is a bit different in the fact of Julie is kind of telling the story through Vladimir, and you know she's not a Jewish person. It's for like a new, and she's younger generation. It's sort of geared towards a younger generation who maybe doesn't know a lot about the Holocaust as a whole. And then we also chose to not be super gruesome with it. I mean, a lot of these films, there's bodies being pushed into graves with bulldozers, and we didn't show that. We didn't feel that was necessary to get the message across and to go back on this journey with Vladimir. You learn about what happened there and the horrors, but we didn't get so graphic, and part of our goal is to have schools use this as a teaching aid, especially in the 8th and 9th grade, when I believe is usually the age level. And we're working on a teacher's guide that will go with the program and be sent out to schools all across the nation. So I do think it's a unique approach to this topic, and also the fact that the pandemic features into the end of this documentary is obviously unique, and I don't think that's been covered before in anything like this.
Yeah, I think part of the focus too on Vladimir and his family, and you know, avoiding the gruesome aspects of it. You know, the fact that his family did die in that, but not necessarily showing, you know, the end results of the crematoriums and stuff was an interesting way to really, you know, show and pick up on the emotions of people was keeping it, you know, with the person and not necessarily the event, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. I think that, you know, when you do a documentary, you can't script it out. So this all kind of developed along the way. And, you know, we shot everything and we got back and, you know, we're looking at about 30 or 40 hours of footage saying, okay, now how do we tell this story? And organically it just develops and, you know, this is what we came up with. And I think it's unique. And so far the response, we've had two showings in town and it's been phenomenal, the response we've had. People say they laughed, they cried, all within an hour show, and they all fall in love with Vladimir.
All right, that does it for this episode of the WAMC News Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks to Pat Bradley for all her great work. Until next time, I'm Ian Pickus.